There are monsters that hide in the dark, and then there are monsters that walk openly among us for years, for decades, unnoticed. They sit next to you on a bus. They pump gas at the same station you do. They drift through truck stops and diners and roadside motels. They pass through cities like smoke. And sometimes, they leave behind nothing but silence. No witnesses, no suspects, no justice. In more than 30 years, women disappeared across the United States. They were mothers. They were daughters. They were sisters and friends and human beings with stories of their own. Some were struggling. Some were invisible to society long before they went missing. But all of them were real, and all of them deserved to come home. Someone was hunting them, a man who kept moving, a man who left almost no evidence behind, a man who understood that if society already refused to see certain women, then their deaths would disappear too. He was right. For 30 plus years, he was right. And then one day, decades after the killing started, this man sat down in a prison cell, and he began to talk. He confessed to 93 murders. 93. A number so large that even seasoned investigators struggled to absorb it. A number that shook the FBI. A number that rewrote the record books. But what made the story stranger than any fiction was what he did with his memories. He did not write them down. He did not speak them all at once. He painted them. Portrait by portrait. Face by face. Woman by woman. Tonight on Among Monsters, we step into the mind of the most prolific serial killer in American history. A man who killed quietly while the country looked away. This is the story of Samuel Little. Welcome back to Among Monsters. I'm your host, Maya Vale. Every week, this podcast takes you inside the darkest cases in American crime. The killers, the disappearances, the investigations that took years, decades, or never came at all. And the victims who deserve to be more than a footnote. Tonight's episode is one I have thought about for a long time. Because the story of Samuel Little isn't just about one man's violence. It's about a system that failed the people it was supposed to protect. It is about who we choose to see and who we allow to disappear. Before we begin, I want to say this clearly. Every woman in this story was a person, not a statistic, not a case number, not a face in a drawing. They had names. They had people who loved them, and they deserved justice. Let's get into it. Samuel McDowell Little was born on June 7, 1940, in Reynolds, Georgia. His mother was a teenager. His father was absent from the beginning. Before Samuel could even form a memory of a home, he was uprooted. He was sent to live with his grandmother in Lorain, Ohio, a small industrial city on the southern shore of Lake Erie, a working-class town full of steelworkers and factory hands. On the surface, it looked like a stable place for a child to grow up, but stability was something Samuel Little would never really know. He grew up quiet, watchful. He had few close friends. Teachers described him as difficult to reach. He struggled in school, not because he wasn't smart. Samuel was actually quite intelligent, but school required sitting still, following rules, fitting inside boundaries, and Samuel Little did not fit anywhere. By the time he was a young teenager, he had already begun drifting into petty crime. Shoplifting, small thefts, street fights. Nothing that set off major alarms. Nothing that made anyone say, "This boy is dangerous." But the pattern was there. At 16, the offenses started getting more serious. At 19, he was arrested for burglary. It was his first trip through the criminal justice system, not his last. Over the following decade, he bounced in and out of trouble. Arrest for theft, for fraud, for assault. He served time. He was released. He drifted. Prison became familiar, but it did not slow him down. Because while the world saw a nuisance criminal racking up petty charges, something else was building inside him. Something darker, something violent, something patient. The making of a predator. Samuel Little had a particular focus when it came to violence. It was directed at women, specifically women whose society had already pushed to the margins. Women who were struggling with addiction. Women who worked in sex work to survive. Women who were poor or living outside of stable communities. These were not random choices. Samuel Little was calculating. He understood on some level that the world paid less attention when certain women went missing. There would be no massive search parties, no news cameras, no public outcry. He had grown up watching the way the world worked. He had watched which people got help and which people got ignored. And he used that knowledge to make himself invisible. He moved constantly. Florida, Texas, California, Tennessee, Mississippi, Georgia, Ohio, Nevada. He traveled by bus, by hitchhiking, by catching rides with strangers. He worked odd jobs just long enough to keep moving. No permanent addresses, no long-term ties, no one who would notice if he suddenly left town. He had also trained as a boxer in his early years. That matters. A boxer, Samuel Little, had built powerful hands and strong arms. He had learned how to control his grip, how to apply force with precision, and he had learned something that would become his signature method of killing, the chokehold. He strangled his victims with his bare hands. Sometimes from behind, sometimes facing them directly. The violence was intimate, brutal, and almost entirely invisible to forensic investigators. There was no gun, no knife, no bullet casings left behind, no obvious wounds that said this was a murder. Many of his victims, when they were found, were ruled natural causes. Or unknown causes, or drug overdoses. Some were listed as Jane Doe's. Some were never found at all, and Samuel Little kept moving. Let's slow down here, because I want you to really sit with what I am about to tell you. From approximately 1970 through 2005, Samuel Little moved across the United States. He traveled through at least 19 states, and during that time, he killed again and again and again. Women disappeared in Georgia. Women disappeared in California. Women disappeared in Texas and Florida and Mississippi and Ohio. Some were found, some were not. And in case after case, the same thing happened. The death was ruled something other than homicide, or the case went cold almost immediately, or the victim was buried as a Jane Doe with no further investigation. There were reasons for this. In the 1970s, police departments across America had almost no way to share information with each other. There was no centralized national database connecting killings from different states. A murder in Atlanta had no visible link to a murder in Los Angeles. They looked like separate, unrelated events. And because Samuel Little never stayed in one city for long, no single police department could build a pattern around him. He was exploiting the gaps between systems. He also understood something else. In the 1970s and 80s, crimes against sex workers and drug users were often given minimum investigative resources. Not everywhere, not by everyone, but the pattern was real and well documented. When a woman without a stable home went missing, the response was frequently slower. The resources were smaller. The follow-through was shorter. Samuel Little understood this with chilling clarity. He chose victims the world had already agreed to overlook. And for three decades, it worked. The ones who were found, not all of his victims, were lost without a trace. Some were discovered. Some cases were opened. Some investigations moved forward. And here is where the story becomes even more troubling. Because Samuel Little was actually caught more than once. In 1982, he was arrested in Mississippi after a woman he attacked survived. She identified him. Charges were filed. Then the case collapsed. Witnesses were unreliable. Evidence was thin. The charges were dropped. He walked free. In 1984, he was tried for murder in Florida. He was acquitted. Let me say that again. He was tried for murder, and he walked out of that courtroom a free man. A year later, in 1985, he was tried for murder again, this time in California. He was acquitted again. Three separate opportunities, three separate chances to stop him. And each time, the system failed. Every single time Samuel Little walked out of that courthouse free, more women died. The timeline between his acquittals and his confirmed killings is not a coincidence. It is a direct line. He did not stop. He could not stop, or he chose not to. And no one stopped him for him. I need to stop here. Because in a story this large, it is easy to get caught up in numbers. 93, 19 states, 30 plus years. And when the numbers get that big, something dangerous happens. The victims become abstract. So let me bring some of them back. Patricia Mount was 26 years old when she was killed in Florida in 1982. She was young and had her whole life ahead of her. Melinda Rose Labar was found in California. She was in her 20s. There was a young woman in Georgia in the late 1970s. For years, she was buried as a Jane Doe. No name, no family notified, no answers. Then came Samuel Little's drawings. An investigator began the long, painstaking work of matching portraits to names, portrait to person, memory to missing case file. Some families finally learned the truth decades later. A daughter in her 50s received a phone call. Someone finally knew what happened to her mother. A sibling who had spent years wondering got an answer they had never expected to get. These are not comfortable stories. There is no clean resolution. There is no moment of relief. There is only the end of not knowing. And sometimes, after decades of silence, that has to be enough. But many of the women in Samuel Little's drawings have never been identified. As of the time of this recording, there are still portraits with no names attached. Still families somewhere who do not know that the drawings exist. Still investigators working to close those gaps. Every single one of those women deserve a name. Every single one of them deserve to be brought home. In 2012, Samuel Little was living at a homeless shelter in Louisville, Kentucky. He was 72 years old. By that point, he had been drifting for over four decades. He had lived outside of stable housing for years. He was aging. He was quieter. He may have seemed like simply another older man trying to get by. When police arrested him in 2012, the charge was not murder. It was drug possession. A routine arrest, the kind that moves through the system quickly and attracts almost no attention. But something happened during the booking process that changed everything. They ran his DNA, and a database search returned a match. Not one match, not two, three. His DNA connected to three unsolved murders in Los Angeles, California. Cold cases from years earlier. Women who had been strangled. Women whose deaths had gone unsolved for over a decade. Samuel Little was extradited to California. And in 2014, after a trial, he was convicted of three counts of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. At the time of sentencing, investigators believed he might be connected to additional killings, but no one had any idea how many. That was about to change in a way no one was prepared for. In 2018, a Texas Ranger named James Holland got access to Samuel Little in prison. James Holland had worked cold cases. He had interviewed killers before. He understood something about men like Samuel Little. Standard interrogation tactics would not work. Pressure would make him close up. Accusations would make him stop talking. Aggression would get investigators nowhere. So Holland tried something different. He did not come in demanding confessions. He did not come in with stacks of evidence and accusatory questions. He sat down with Samuel Little and treated him like a storyteller. He listened. He asked questions that showed genuine curiosity rather than just prosecutorial interest. He let Little talk about his life, his travels, his memories, and slowly, carefully, like a tide coming in, Samuel Little began to open up. He started talking about cities that he had visited, roads he had traveled, motels he had stayed in, and then the details started coming. He described a woman he had met in a specific city in a specific year. He described what she looked like, what she was wearing, what time of night it was. He described the circumstances of her death with a calm that unsettled investigators, even when they had years of experience with violent criminals. He kept going. More cities, more women, more details. 50 confessions, then 60, then 70, then more. The confessions kept coming over weeks and months of interviews. James Holland later described the process as unlike anything he had experienced in his career. Samuel Little was not bragging in a loud or dramatic way. He was remembering, methodically, calmly, in detail. And investigators had to figure out whether any of it was real. When the FBI began the process of verifying Samuel Little's confessions, it was not a simple task. Some of the murders he described had occurred in the early 1970s. 50 years earlier. Evidence was gone. Witnesses had died. Records had been lost and never properly filed. But investigators had something Samuel Little gave them. Details. Specific details that only the killer could know. Details that had never been made public. Details that matched buried case files in ways that could not be explained by coincidence. He described the location where a body had been found. Investigators checked. He was right. He described physical features of a victim. Investigators cross-referenced an old Jane Doe case. The description matched. Case by case, the number of confirmed killings grew. Eventually, the FBI made an official announcement. Samuel Little was credibly linked to 93 murders. 93. The FBI declared him the most prolific confirmed serial killer in American history. More than Ted Bundy. More than John Wayne Gacy. More than Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer. Samuel Little had killed more than all of them, and almost no one had known his name. Now I want to talk to you about the paintings, because this part of Samuel Little's story is unlike anything I have encountered in true crime research. During his time in prison, Samuel Little drew portraits. Not rough sketches, real portraits. He used colored pencils and whatever materials investigators allowed him. And he drew the women he had killed. He drew their faces from memory, their hairstyles, the shapes of their eyes, the colors of their lipstick, their expressions in moments that only he had witnessed. Some women were drawn smiling. Some looked sad. Some looked directly out of the frame. Each drawing was a memory, a locked record of a life he had taken. Samuel Little had a particular ability to remember faces. He could describe what a woman looked like decades after killing her. He could recall small visual details, a scar, a particular way she styled her hair, the color of earrings she was wearing. When investigators shared his drawings publicly, the response was immediate. Families recognized faces. A woman saw a drawing and recognized her aunt. A man saw a portrait and knew it was his cousin. For some families, the drawings provided the first real lead in decades. The FBI and various state agencies worked to identify every face in every drawing. Some were confirmed relatively quickly. Others took years of painstaking work. And some, even today, remain identified. The drawings became one of the most unusual investigative tools in the history of American law enforcement. Portraits by a killer used to bring his victims home. This is the question that haunts this story. How does someone kill 93 people over 35 years and not get caught? The answer is not simple, but it is important. The first factor is mobility. Samuel Little never stopped moving. He traveled constantly between cities and states. Each killing happened in a different jurisdiction. Each jurisdiction investigated the case on its own, with almost no connection to similar cases happening elsewhere. A detective in Mississippi had no way to know that a man she might be looking for had just killed someone in California. A police department in Texas had no connection to a cold case file in Florida. The American law enforcement system in the 1970s and 1980s was deeply fragmented. There was no centralized national database that could flag similar crimes across state lines the way modern tools can. Samuel Little moved through those gaps like water through a cracked wall. The second factor is the deliberate targeting of vulnerable victims. This is a painful truth, and I want to say it plainly. For decades in America, crimes against women in poverty, women in addiction, women in sex work, were not given the same investigative resources as crimes against women who fit a different social profile. The pattern is real and documented. When women without a stable address went missing, the response was often slower, smaller, and shorter. Samuel Little knew this. He selected victims based in part of the knowledge that their deaths would receive less scrutiny. That is not a statement about the victims. It is a statement about the system that failed them. The third factor is his method. Strangulation leaves almost no external evidence when performed by someone who knows what they are doing. Samuel Little had trained as a boxer. He had strong hands and precise control. In case after case, his victims were found and a cause of death was unclear. Some were ruled natural. Some were ruled overdose. the possibility of homicide was not always considered. Put all three of those factors together. A man who never stopped moving. Victims the system had already deprioritized. A killing method that produced almost no forensic evidence. And you begin to understand how 93 murders disappeared across three decades. Samuel Little was not what most people picture when they think of a serial killer. He was not dramatic. He was not theatrical. He was quiet, observant, patient. He blended in because he looked ordinary, a drifter, a traveler, a man working odd jobs and staying in cheap motels. Nobody noticed him because there was nothing obvious to notice. When investigators got to know him through the long interview process, a more complex picture emerged. Samuel Little was highly intelligent. He had a detailed and precise memory. He thought carefully before speaking. He understood people in a predatory way, reading them, assessing them, figuring out who they were. He also had a significant capacity for self-justification. He described his victims in ways that distanced them from full humanity in his mind. This is common in predators of this type. The internal psychology allows the violence to continue by removing full moral weight from it. But here is what made Samuel different from many other killers investigators had dealt with. He remembered. He remembered his victims with extraordinary clarity. Faces, details, locations, circumstances. And late in his life, sitting in prison with nowhere left to go, something shifted. He started talking. And when he started, he could not seem to stop. Samuel Little spent the last years of his life doing something unexpected. He helped. He sat down with investigators from multiple states. He described cases in detail. He cooperated with efforts to identify his victims. He drew more portraits. He answered questions. He provided information that helped reopen cold cases and finally gave families answers. Why? People who spoke with him extensively offered different theories. Some believed he was simply tired. He was old. His health was failing. And there was a part of him that wanted to be recognized for what he had done. He wanted to be seen, not celebrated, but seen. For a man who had lived anonymously for decades, the confessions were in some ways a form of becoming real. Other investigators believed it was more transactional. He cooperated because cooperation gave him a small measure of control. He had things investigators wanted. And giving them access to those things gave him something in return. Whatever the reason, the information he provided was real, and it helped. In 2019, the FBI released a public call for help identifying remaining victims. They shared Samuel Little's drawings widely. They asked the public to look and to come forward. The response was significant. Tips came in from across the country. Some led to confirmed identifications. The work continued. Samuel Little died on December 30th, 2020. He was 80 years old. He died in a California state prison. He died as the most prolific, confirmed serial killer in American history. And he left behind an unknown number of cases still unresolved. Before we close, I want to do something. I want to name some of the women who have been identified as Samuel Little's victims because they deserve to be named. Melinda Rose Labar, California, 1984. Patricia Ann Mount, Florida, 1982. Guadalupe Apodaca, California, 1987. Rose Hill, California, 1986. Carol Elford, California, 1987. Aubrey Nelson, Mississippi, 1978. Ferdona Smith, Texas, 1994. Mary Jo Papier, Ohio, 2003. And the unnamed ones. A woman with bright earrings and a kind expression captured in charcoal. still waiting for someone to recognize her face. A young woman drawn with her hair swept up, still a Jane Doe after all these years. A woman whose portrait Samuel Little drew from memory decades after he killed her, whose family may still be out there, still wondering. They were real, every single one. And the fact that some of them still have no name is not acceptable. It has to be said out loud. It has to be treated as unfinished business, because it is. The story of Samuel Little forces a reckoning. How does someone kill 93 people across 35 years without being stopped? Part of the answer is his intelligence and his careful planning. Part of it is his constant movement across state lines. Part of it is the method he used, which left almost no physical evidence. But a large part of the answer is something we have to sit with honestly. He was not stopped sooner because the women he killed were not seen as worth stopping for. Not by everyone, but by enough of the systems that were supposed to protect them. And that is a collective failure. Not by any one person, not by any one department, but of the values we embedded in our institutions, of who we decided mattered. Samuel Little saw the blind spot, and he used it for decades. The women he killed did not deserve to be invisible. They did not deserve to be forgotten. They did not deserve to wait decades for someone to say their names out loud. They deserved protection. They deserved investigation. They deserved the full weight of justice. Thank you for spending time with me tonight on Among Monsters. I'm Maya Vail. This podcast exists because these stories deserve to be told. Not just the dramatic ones. Not just the ones the world already knows. The overlooked ones. The complicated ones. The ones where justice was slow or partial or never came at all. If you're listening and you think you recognize a face from Samuel Little's drawings, please reach out to the FBI's tip line. The work of identifying his victims is still ongoing, and your information could matter more than you know. If you found value in tonight's episode, please follow Among Monsters wherever you listen to your podcast. Share the show with someone you think would connect with this kind of storytelling. Leave me a review if you have a moment. It genuinely helps. Until next time, I'm Maya Vail. Stay curious, stay aware, and remember, monsters are real, and sometimes they walk quietly among us.